Thank you very much, and thanks a lot for the invitation. I mean, it's been a while since I've been last time at Perimeter in 2008, and I still remember I was using an ice hockey stick as a pointer. So that's not the case today. I would have to resort to this kind of modern technology.
Yeah, they haven't implemented that on Zoom yet.
Yes, indeed. So yeah. So from what I understood from like our conversation with Kirill and Leighton, you are interested in octonions and like the SO10, or better to say spin SO10, pops up because it has this kind of fancy 16 dimensional representation, which has something to do with octonions. So today, I would like to talk about the SO10 from the other side of the barricade, so to say. So I would like to talk about how do we really construct like different SO10 guts. But this is, of course, like always serving some purpose. Those constructions are serving some purpose. So maybe I would like every now and then I would kind of divert from this kind of model building perspective. And necessarily, I would need to tell you also something about what the guts are good for, what they are all about. And then I would kind of pass through various criteria, or better to say constraints, which are usually imposed on the SO10 constructions. And I would like to say, put this into the context or kind of illustrate how these criteria are used in practice on a very specific scenario. So I would tell you the story of what I call the minimal reasonable SO10 ground unification. And you will see that this is actually a pretty unique, or those constraints that I will be talking about kind of point to this very specific scenario, which may be really the gut. So let's start. So for you, like 16 of the SO10, sorry for the language here. I will most of the time speak about algebra. So I would use SO10, of course you would maybe prefer spin 10 or something else. But I'm a physicist, so I really apologize for this. So from the phenomenology point of view, the 16 of 10, or sorry, of SO10, is very interesting because it can accommodate the entire standard model family of matter, which means the left-handed quarks, which form a doublet under the SU2, also left-handed leptons, and those SU2 singlets, which are the down quarks, right-handed down quarks, right-handed up quarks, and right-handed charged leptons. So this is really perfect. And here, this is nothing but the quantum numbers of 16. If you take it as a reducible representation of the standard model symmetry, but this matching is not really super perfect because there's still this one little slot here which remains empty. But if, like, with a closer look, you would very soon realize that actually this empty slot here is really ready made to support one of the most humble yet, I would say, most fruitful and interesting hypothesis about the beyond standard model of physics that's very often made. And I mean it can it can take like a full semester to really exploit it, and that's the existence of the guy that's missing from here. I mean, you can see like two left-handed doublets but only three right-handed fields, and the guy that's missing here is the right-handed neutrino. And indeed, the right-handed neutrino, being a neutrino, is a very sterile thing. It corresponds to the fact that this slot is actually a full singlet. And what's really, really interesting is that actually you don't need the full SO10 to kind of support this claim that there may be, or there should be perhaps, something like right-handed neutrino in the nature. It's sufficient to look at this structure, at those representations that I've written here, from the standard model perspective, because there's something very, very interesting qualitatively about having right-handed neutrino on top of those other fields. And you can already see it from this kind of rearrangement. So we have doublets of left-handed fields, but singlets of right-handed fields. But if you write down, or if you write down their SU2 and U1 quantum numbers, that means the SU2 Cartan and the hypercharge, which, by the way, gives you, I mean, their sum gives you the electric charge in this third column, you notice something very interesting. And that's the correlation between the electric charges, or better to say hypercharges, and this B minus L. This B minus L is the baryon number minus the lepton number, quantum number. Baryon number is 1/3 for the quarks. That means here in this first half of the table, and zero for leptons, whilst lepton number is zero for the upper part and one for the leptons. So B minus L, actually it's a half of it, is displayed here. And there's something very interesting about it, because this number is the same like this one, and this number is the same like this one. So there's no offset for the left-handed fields. If you want to apply a similar logic to the right-handed fields, what you encounter or what you notice practically immediately is that B minus L is offset from hypercharges by something which is very interesting, by plus 1/2 and minus 1/2 for the upper and down type, for the up and down type, say quarks and also leptons. So it looks like the standard model matter fields, including right-handed neutrinos, are conforming a very special pattern in which also right-handed fields can be accommodated in a doublet of something, and this something is actually acting on the right-handed fields only. So it looks like we are restoring like something like a left-right symmetry with like taking B minus L into play, and the electric charge is like, corresponds to this very, very beautiful and very symmetric and very physical formula, because B minus L is something that has a clear physical meaning. So let me take this like at face value and exploit this observation. So let me promote the standard model symmetry to something which is left-right symmetric. That means making the doublets of these SU2R also out of these two sets of fields. And this is very, very interesting, because all of a sudden nature is left-right symmetric. That means we have something like parity restoration. So this kind of very asymmetric picture, I would even say the maximum parity violating low energy theory, which is the standard model, can be interpreted as a low energy limit of something which does not which is not asymmetric, which is very symmetric between left and right. But this is only like one perspective. One can go even further and take these fields, reshuffle them a little bit, and notice that actually the SU3 and U1 B minus L here can be further combined into something like SU4. Because the third Cartan of it, of the SU4, is exactly proportional to the B minus L charge. So in principle, you may further group left-handed fields into one fourplet of the SU4, and the right-handed fields also into another fourplet of SU4. And this is only one step from the SO10, right? Because SU4 is locally isomorphic to SO6. And the SU2L times SU2R is locally isomorphic to SO4. So we have got SO6 times SO4 here. So it's very, very natural to expect that these fields taken all together would indeed conform something like a 16-dimensional representation of the SO10, right? So this is not like a surprise. What's really surprising is that these thoughts have been performed even before standard model was really established, that even before the charm discovery, when the second family was not even complete. So this is very, very interesting. But I can offer you another perspective on looking at the same set of fields. You don't need to go to the SO10. You may also group them in a slightly different way, like this, for instance, right? And what you get are three irreducible representations of SU5 instead. And actually, this is historically the really first incarnation of the grand unification idea. like grand unification, meaning that the classification or the symmetry group or the gauge group, if you like, is something which is simple, which is not like factorized, but which is like a simple thing. And this is the paper in which already in 1974, Georgia and Glashow claim that actually at the level of rank four symmetries, this is SU5 is even unique. There is no way around the SU5 if you are specialized or if you want to look at the metric contents of the standard model from the rank four perspective. So it's interesting, but so far this has been nothing but language. We were just kind of reshuffling different things that we encounter in the standard model into different representations. So this is not yet got the true, I would say, guts of the guts. What makes different unifications really different is not that much the reshuffling of the fields. It's actually the dynamics which is behind it. And in particular, the extra degrees of freedom. I mean, for us, like phenomenologists, it's namely the dynamics which is either mediated by those extra degrees of freedom, or perhaps even the physics of those extra degrees of freedom on their own. That means like taking those fields as asymptotic states in principle, which is interesting. And that's what makes a big difference across different types of, say, symmetries that I was talking about. So for instance, taking this minimal rank four unification, you encounter such an extra degree of freedom immediately when you look at the gauge sector. As you know, like in gauge theories, the gauge fields are, at least if those theories are supposed to be renormalizable, typically accommodated in the adjoint representations. So the adjoint of SU5 is 24 dimensional. And again, if you decompose it with respect to standard model symmetry, you will encounter something you know very well, gluons, A fields and B fields of the standard model. But you also encounter something extra, an extra vector pair, which has very, very interesting quantum numbers. Besides gauge fields, you have the standard model Higgs, and you also need to accommodate it somewhere. And the simplest such representation is actually the five-dimensional vector. And again, like the Higgs is a doublet, so there are still 3 degrees of freedom, complex degrees of freedom, which correspond to new fields. So I will call this extra triplet delta. And there is another thing which scalars should do for you in unifications, and that's the symmetry breaking from the unified, simple structure down to the standard model. And in case of the SU5, because it's rank four, you don't have that many options because you need to preserve the rank because standard model is also rank four. And the standard choice is 24, again, the adjoint, but now adjoint of scalars, because the adjoint representations never break rank. I mean, if you have a VEF in the adjoint representation, you preserve the rank. So the typical scheme is a scheme with 24 in the scale, extra 24 in the scalar sector. And again, you have this number of new fields. Actually, these last ones, these are would-be Goldstone bosons, which would make this X eventually massive. So they are not propagating, but the rest of the spectrum actually is. So this is the example of all those extra degrees of freedom that you always encounter if you take this unification idea seriously. And it becomes even more interesting if you go to the SO10, because unlike for the SU5, where things are more or less settled by the low rank and other things, the SO10 is a model building maze. And one can even say that the SO10 models are often entirely defined by the scalar sector, because considering matter, which perfectly fits in the 16, you don't need to do more than that, than fitting it into the 16. All the work is typically deferred to the scalars. And it's a real mess, because if you now go to, for instance, Slansky or other, group theory books, what you encounter is actually a number of options. The point is that SO10 is rank 5, so you can, you are not limited by the need to preserve the rank. You can afford breaking it or reducing it by one unit down to the standard model. And so there are many options. So like I've here listed just like the first eight smallest irreducible representations besides singlet that you find in Slansky. And actually it's pretty common to use the SU4 times SU2 times SU2 classification here. So these are their decompositions with respect to this subgroup. Now, of course, the question is, which of these to select? I mean, is there any kind of unique selection, or what are the guiding principles in this kind of SO10 model building? So there are essentially like two basic principles to follow here. First, this extra degree, I mean, the scalar degrees of freedom or the scalar sector should provide the right symmetry breaking. And second, scalars should support the flavor structure or give you something, a flavor structure like the Higgs in the standard model does, which is at least potentially realistic. So one can actually go through all these representations and ask whether there are singlets contained in there, standard model singlets, which can then receive a VEF, which would preserve the standard model symmetry as an effective low energy symmetry. And if you look at 10, there's none of these. So 10 is not certainly a representation to choose for the SO10 symmetry breaking. 16 is slightly better because it does contain a standard model singlet in here, but it's again problematic because this singlet does not break the SU5 subgroup of SO10. So it's not a realistic breaking. 16 cannot per se trigger a realistic breaking. 45, the adjoint, can also not trigger a realistic breaking down to the standard model because it cannot break through the SU3 times SU2 left times U1R times U1B minus L subgroup of the SO10. So this is also not sufficient. The same for 54, which cannot break through the Patisalam, for instance. Going ahead, like 120 does not contain any of those red fields. That means no standard model singlet is available with 120. 126, there's one standard model singlet, but it suffers from the same pathology like the 16. This singlet here is also an SU5 singlet. So if you give a VEF to this field, then you do not break through the SU5 subgroup of the SO10. So the first multiplet actually, which can do the whole thing, that means the whole breaking from the SO10 down to the standard model, is actually 144. Which is pretty large on one side. On the other side, I mean, it's relatively, I would say, contrived in a sense that the Higgs models based on the 144 are quite, I would say, ill-behaved. I can go to that later on. I would call this a rather singular situation. Usually the breaking is like one step I will comment on that later. So this is also not like the best way to do that. 210, again, like a similar problem, like with 54 and 45, it does not go down to the very standard model. And so on and so forth. So actually from here, from this one lesson or from this analysis, we learned a lesson that at least for, I would say, standard SO10 model building, always at least a pair of these scalars is needed, probably even more because it's not only about the standard model singlets, it's also about a standard model Higgs-like doublets, which you need in order to support flavor. And usually, like one displays.
Can I ask a quick question about the previous slide?
Absolutely.
So for example, for the 210, if you wanted to see that couldn't break you all the way down to the standard model, does that involve writing down, you know, the most general potential you can build from the 210 and seeing what VEVs it can have and then checking whether any of those break all the way down? Or is there a simpler way to do that?
Well, that depends on, That's what we usually do. Like we write down the potential minimize, I would say that there should be a simpler way. I think U1 B minus is not broken by any of these. So you have an extra symmetry, but I would have to check it. I don't have any, I would say, clever answer to this. At least not for standard SO10. In the SUSY SO10, you sometimes can argue that due to the F flatness and D flatness condition, especially the F flatness, those VEFs that are allowed, those singlet VEFs, have to be aligned with other VEFs in the in the pool. And sometimes you can, I mean, it's easier to argue on the SUSY side, but I'm not sure whether I have a simple argument for this at the non-SUSY side. So I can take a look and we can discuss later.
No problem. Yeah, thank you. One last question actually while we're on this. So the 144 you said could in principle do the breaking. Is the idea that then it breaks you down to the standard model, but then you still need a different field to be the standard model Higgs, or?
Well, that again depends on whether those doublets which are here are enough to provide a realistic flavor pattern. So this is a question I would like to postpone to the end, because that's where I would discuss it for this minimal SO10, so you may see what are the constraints there, for instance.
Okay, thank you.
So, like, let me now like come back to this picture. So we have learned that, like in most cases, or like in those potentially realistic cases, you need at least two Higgs representations, and this is quite a lot, especially if you try to write down the complete set of singlet contractions of such a pair of representations. The more that you can use complex conjugation if you are not in the SUSY context. So there is a lot. And it may be problematic, but on the other hand, like the fact that we have more than a single Higgs, that opens the door to multiple scales. I mean, you can easily accommodate like more than a single physical scale in such a way that, for instance, you use 45, 54, or 210 to break down to the this symmetry, which is the 3 SU3 times SU2 L times U1 R times U1 B minus L, and then of course you need one of those complex guys which can break through U1 B minus L. So typically, something which is not 126 and 16 takes you from SO10 into the maze. And then 126 or 16, if I'm sticking to small representations, takes you out of the maze down to the standard model. But as I said, like there are multiple options, and one has to impose like further constraints. So I think this is the take-home slide, which I try to somehow classify different types of constraints. So I would say that one can identify roughly three different types. One of them, the first, I would call the structure constraints. Those are those constraints which you impose at the very beginning, which actually define the dimensionality of the parameter space. They tell you how many parameters you have to work with, and so on and so forth. So for instance, whether to take a supersymmetric or non-supersymmetric theory, whether it should be renormalizable, non-renormalizable, how do you select your irreducible representations, whether you want to be minimal on one or the other side, because minimality here in this context is not like a priori clear what it means. Like some people prefer minimality in the sense of like the minimal dimensionality of the Higgs sector. Other people prefer like the minimal number of couplings, and that's also my personal preference. Then, and so on and so forth. Then, like the second set of constraints that one can identify correspond to like the consistency of the framework as a quantum field theory. So sometimes you take your parameter space as something which is frozen for the moment, and you discard, say, obviously wrong or useless patches of it, which means that you, for instance, you want your parameters to correspond to a at least locally stable standard model vacuum. That means you should have no tachyons in the spectrum in the standard model vacuum. You also want to be perturbative typically because you want to calculate something. And this something is actually bringing me to the third set or to the third category, which I would call like doing physics. Like we want to look at those remaining patches of the parameter space and look at numbers and do some phenomenology. In particular, we want, of course, to be compatible with the standard model. We perhaps we would be very happy to address some of its shortcomings. And of course, like eventually, we would want to provide a prediction, which is, of course, as you can see, like which makes guts or which makes such a framework like a really physical framework in the best Popperian sense, I would say. And those three sets of constraints are actually interesting, like because like you can see a very clear like increase in the cost of it. So this is typically like taking a long time. This is something that you can do like in few minutes, like if you decide to model, I mean to say construct your new model. But actually, I would like to make a short digression. Because I mentioned several times that we want to calculate something. So what's this something that we want to calculate? In other words, what are the guts really good for? What they are about? And I would like to say that actually, like, I mean, people again, like are not really concurrent on this, but my personal viewpoint is that grand unification is namely a theory of charge quantization. It's like, asking, for instance, like what the standard model is about. I mean, standard model is a perfect theory of weak interactions, but it's certainly not a theory of flavor, right? So here, grand unifications are certainly also not like full theories of flavor, but I believe that they are, or I claim that they are theories of charge quantization, simply because the simple symmetry structure provides non-trivial algebraic relations between quantum numbers, right? And those quantum numbers, I mean, irrespective of what kind of representations you are talking about. Okay, you can say, okay, like even in the standard model, the anomalies quantize hypercharge, but this is true only as long as you do not, claim that neutrinos are Dirac fields, which means like they are massive, but their masses resemble very closely to, I mean, those masses in the quark sector. Because if they are, then you do not have hypercharge quantized, because there is always like an arbitrary fraction of B minus LC charge that you can add to any hypercharge you prefer, or the standard model hypercharge, so to say, and still you would get an anomaly-free charge. So this breaks totally this very beautiful hypercharge quantization of the standard model if you just put right-handed neutrinos into the game and you pretend that neutrino masses are Dirac. This is not the case for Majorana. So I would rather now, I mean, from now on, I would always consider neutrinos to be Majorana. The other thing which guts really, really predict are monopoles because of the topological features of the vacuum manifold, right? So, yeah, that's something that you cannot really get rid of in the guts. On the other hand, like monopoles are as you know, are highly non-perturbative objects. So, it's really difficult to calculate anything about them. But still, if there was a monopole somewhere, then like that would be a very, very strong indication that maybe nature does fancy a unified symmetry in some way. What I would like to focus on is actually another aspect, and that's the crosstalk among quarks and leptons, which are indeed like members of the same multiplet. So like gauge transitions would very naturally bring a quark into lepton, and so on and so forth. The same applies also to the interactions with scalars. That means the Yukawa sector of the theory actually. In that respect, GATs can be at least to some extent exploited as theories of at least some flavor, in a sense that, I mean, the grouping of the matter fields within these bigger representations, say, constrains the number of Yukawas that you can write down and gives you something about, or tells you something about the effective mass matrices, like it enforces a symmetric uptype quark mass matrix and so on and so forth. But this is not what I would really want to go into. What I would like to do is actually exploit the fundamental instability of matter that the GATs are, say, inflicting. The point is that those new degrees of freedom that we have, for instance, seen in the SU5, remember this X field and delta fields that I was displaying, they actually induce transitions which are otherwise forbidden in the standard model. And these transitions actually correspond to nothing smaller than proton decay. I mean, matter is not stable in grand unifications, right? From the standard model perspective, these operators correspond to dimension 6. However, you cannot really tell much about them from the standard model perspective, because these effective scales, the suppression scales, which restore dimensionality here, are free parameters. But the point is that actually in GATs, these are not free parameters anymore. The scale of this new physics, the masses of those X and delta fields can be predicted. And this has to do with a very simple phenomenon, and that's the running of the gauge couplings. So in a sense, even the very standard model gauge couplings encode or tell us about this potential new scale or potential new dynamic scale in such a way that, you just look at the low energy inputs, low energy SU3, like non-abelian couplings like this, for instance, and you evolve them along their beta functions, and you encounter like a very interesting intersection at some very large scale. And this may be just a coincidence. Like if you evolve the same couplings within the same framework further on, they would again divert. But what if you integrate in exactly those new degrees of freedom that I was talking about, the X fields and the delta fields, and kind of restore the full SU5 structure? It's almost a tautology that in such a case, you end up in a scenario in which there's only a single gauge coupling, because indeed like this gauge symmetry is simple. But this whole thing makes sense only if you do this, if you integrate X and delta into the play at this very specific scale, at this and only this scale. And this is something which sets the dynamics. It tells us what the masses of the X and delta should be. Okay, so this is the main beauty of the unification. It is a theory of baryon number violation, and it tells us where to expect this new dynamics. Well, actually, I should mention that this very simple picture that I presented is not really compatible with the SU5, because what you want to hit is this point. And if you take this seriously and work it out, again, like towards the standard model scale, you will not hit it. But this doesn't necessarily mean that like GATs are wrong, because the SU5 is just the minimal or historically first attempt on them. And you may be, I mean, you can learn other things from those gauge couplings. Maybe that actually the standard model gauge couplings encode two scales rather than a single one. Recall that in the SO10, indeed, like you can have easily like two rather than one like symmetry breaking scales. And this would then, I mean, the same picture would then look like this. You would have an SO10 at the very high scale, like for instance, a left-right stage in between here and here. And eventually you would break the SU2R times U1B minus R into the hypercharge, and the running would look like this, for instance. So in a sense, the standard model couplings can tell us not only about this scale, but also about this scale, which is very, very interesting. Okay, like maybe like some people interpret this like an indication for supersymmetry, because if you really believe in lower scale supersymmetry, like the picture changes like this, and you again hit the standard model data. On the other hand, I mean, like we don't see any TV scale supersymmetry at the LHC. And with what is even more problematic perhaps is that there's actually no room for an intermediate scale here. And we will see in a minute that the intermediate scale is actually something which may be very, very important. So let me come back now to the SO10 model building constraints and go like category after category and like tell you about how these are really implemented in the SO10 model building. I will look first at these basic structural constraints, and I will deliberately confine myself within the realm of non-supersymmetric theories, because SUSY is an extra assumption. And if you see or not see something in the experiment, you don't know whether you are testing the SUSY hypothesis or the unification hypothesis. So I will certainly go non-SUSY, or prefer going non-SUSY. I would also prefer going renormalizable, because renormalizable frameworks are very nice, because they are not really contrived by, say, this Pandora box of higher dimensional operators. They are typically way better, on the calculability side. You typically don't know what the new scale associated with the non-renormalizable operators are is, and so on and so forth. And I will look at minimal SO10s, and I will specify what the minimality means here. And I will show you everything on the story of the minimal SO10. Right, or what I call the minimal SO10 gut. So let me come back to this symmetry breaking maze that I was talking about a few minutes ago. So as I said, we need one representation to take you into the maze, and the other one, either 16 or 126, if we stick to small multiplets, to take you out of the maze. And now you can try and look how to get through the maze, whilst being as simple as possible, not paying much for it. And if you look carefully, you will sooner or later encounter this 45 dimensional adjoint option. So 45 as an adjoint can contain two different vacuum expectation values, because it contains two different standard model singlets. And depending on the hierarchy of these two omegas, so to say, it takes you either this way to this last available before standard model symmetry, or this way, again, depending on the hierarchy between omega y and omega r. And then one of these two will take you out of the maze, but which one? So I would say that optically, at least, the minimal Higgs models can be those based on the breaking by 45 and either 16 or 126, or of course something way, way bigger than that. Notice also that 210 can also take you all the way down to this symmetry just above the standard model. But there, the number of degrees of freedom is way bigger. So I will first explore this 45. And later on, you will see that this is not only the simplest or the least, the lowest dimensionality option, but it's also very good from another perspective. To stick to this 45. But the question now is, is it 45 plus 16 or 45 plus 126? Because both these guys can take you out of the maze. And in order to answer this, I would have to like remind you about some phenomenology concerning neutrino masses. So in the standard model, you can write down a neutrino mass operator if you take it as, I mean, as an effective theory. That means you open the Pandora box of non-renormalizable operators and you encounter a very unique operator dimension 5, which is called the Weinberg's operator. It looks like this. You have two Higgses and two leptonic doublets. And there's some suppression scale, which you don't know, but you can still say something about it because this scale may have something to do with the U1 B minus L breaking. Because indeed, if U1 B minus L was unbroken, you cannot write down such an operator because it carries two units of lepton number. There's no star here on the L, no bar, nothing. It's LL really. So U1 B minus L must be broken actually by two units before you can write down this operator. Okay, do we know something about lambda, like from the experiment? The answer is yes, we know. We know quite a lot from the oscillations, from neutron oscillations, and also from cosmology and beta decay experiments, which both tell us something about the masses of light neutrinos. And if you translate these constraints, which put them somewhere into the sub-EV ballpark, into constraints onto this lambda, what you encounter is something like this. This lambda scale should not be the God scale. It should be several orders of magnitude below the God scale. So this U1 B minus L breaking should perhaps happen below the God scale. And we are back to that situation that I've shown you, that maybe like we not only can have intermediate scales, but it's desirable to have them because of this. So is it 16 or 126 from this point of view? Well, if you break the U1 B minus L by 16, you in general encounter some problems because if the 16 is the U1 B minus L breaking scalar, if that intermediate symmetry, if that U1 B minus L is significantly below the God scale, then because you need two units of B minus L breaking and 16 provides only one, it actually the effective seesaw scale comes as 16 squared over some cutoff if you play seesaw in this non-renormalizable way. But this typically has like scale problems because, I mean, there's this square. So, and this, I mean, this scale can be the Planck scale, for instance. So this is certainly not the way to go. It's very different if you actually assume that it's 126 which breaks B minus L, because this 126 breaks B minus L by two units. So you need only one. You need only one power of it. You need only one power of the VEF there, which means that you don't need to resort to any higher dimensional operators. It's just the seesaw scale is the VEF of 126. So you are in a way better shape with predictivity. And you are also in a way better shape with the overall scale because there is no square of this intermediate scale, right? So, and that's what brings me actually to the very definition of what I think is the minimal SOTAN gut. The minimal Higgs model of this kind should be spent perhaps on the 45 and 126. So let's take a look at how it can look like. And don't be scared here. Like there's a lot of structures, but this is the potential. And these are abbreviations for different terms here. But okay, yeah, it's not so ugly. This is the renormalizable version of it. But still it contains something like 15 couplings. So here you see how difficult the life can be if you do admit two scalar representations into play, although you motivate them really very well. Like why do you select just 45 and 126? Still you have many, many couplings. And those couplings, the number of the couplings grows really fast if you admit something else into the game. So in a sense, this is not really a Higgs model. This is a nightmare. Because now the next step is to work this out to calculate the spectrum and so on and so forth. And it's really, really a lot of work to do that. But actually, this is the best we can even do. And the reason is that this framework is very, very unique concerning the calculability, the practical calculability of the unification scale. Okay, why is that? Well, if you really want to calculate the unification scale, that means essentially the intersection point of all these three couplings, you better work with like the precision that you can attain somehow. So at least at two loops concerning the evolution of the gauge couplings. And the reason is that actually they meet under relatively shallow angles. So their intersection, if there are some theoretical uncertainties, cannot be really identified very well. There is always some theoretical uncertainty like related to those theoretical uncertainties in the approximations you are using. For instance, in one loop, these bends would be very way bigger, and so on and so forth. However, this is not the whole story. You need more information. I already said that you need to work out the scalar spectrum. And the reason is here. If you want to really determine the gut scale, you need to know something about the threshold, something about the fields which you integrate into the play at around this scale, because each single non-singlet field like kicks a little bit the running. So in order to get complete information, you really need to work out the scalar spectrum. And that potential that I showed you before has got like several billions of individual terms, of course, all of them parameterized by those 15 couplings. So this really looks like a nightmare. And one can necessarily ask the question whether it's really worth the hassle, because like it's really difficult. But the answer is absolutely. Actually, one has to do this because, especially has to do this in this 45 model, class of models, because they are very unique in a sense. And the uniqueness actually consists in the fact that those 45 models are very, very special concerning like Planck suppressed operators or certain classes of Planck suppressed operators, for instance, like this one. So this is a dimension 5 operator. You can always write down in any grand unification, or at least almost always, the F mu nu, these are the kinetic forms, the phi, that's the gut breaking scalar, and it's VEF. So in the broken phase, you see that this actually kicks the kinetic form of the gauge fields by an unknown amount, because you don't know really what this scale is. It can be a Planck scale, but you don't know the coefficient here. And the point is that even like as small effects as say one 1% kick to this kinetic form produces a very, very big theoretical uncertainty in this pattern, because simply you don't know how to match those theories. I mean, how to match the gut theory to the standard model, because you need to first canonically renormalize the gauge fields, which inflicts like out of control shifts on the definitions or in the definitions of the gauge couplings. So something like this happens if such operators are around. And this is a death blow to any predictivity whatsoever for most guts. Because if the uncertainties due to the presence of such operators is this huge, then you cannot really calculate anything. You can derive like constraints on the gut scale like within like an order of magnitude or maybe two orders of magnitude. And this makes it, I mean, this gut scale uncertainty makes it in the fourth power into the, say, proton lifetime prediction. So this is a real death blow. And remarkably, or like almost all other unifications besides this 45 driven SO10 suffer from this problem. Because in order for such an operator to be absent, I mean, the gut-breaking scalar should not be in the symmetric product of the edge joints of the gut symmetry. And if you look at the SU5, the symmetric product of the edge joints is 24 times 24 symmetric, which is 24, 75, and 200. And 24 and 75 are the usual suspects. I mean, these are the usual representations that you use for the breaking of the SU5. So that means that you cannot get rid of such an operator in the SU5s, at least not in those like reasonable ones. In the SO10s, you get also, I mean, you discard also many options by this argument. You discard a 54 breaking. You also discard a 210 breaking. I mean, this is the main reason why I'm not really fencing this 210 as a symmetry breaking agent, because simply you don't get rid of those very, very dangerous and very pathological dimension five operators. But in the 45 case, this operator is identically zero, right? You cannot write it down, essentially. So that's another, I would say, incarnation of one of those guiding principles in this SO10 framework. So if you want to play with SO10, then you better do it with 45. If you want to calculate something in this kind of cuts, then you better break the SO10 symmetry by the edge joint. Okay, so we have passed through most of those basic structural constraints. So let me now go to the consistency. Again, within this 45 plus 60 model. So what's the consistency here? As I said, I mean, it's mainly the vacuum stability. I mean, that means no tachyons in the spectrum, perturbativity, and so on. The very bad thing about this minimal SO10 broken by 45 and 126 is that actually it's ruled out, or it has been ruled out already in 1980s on the basis of non-tachyonicity of the standard model vacuum. Why is that? I mean, if you really go and work out the spectrum, then you encounter two fields whose mass squares, I mean, two scalar fields whose mass squares are given by these simple formulae. So they are entirely given by a single parameter and differences of those two types of VEFs, which you get in the 45, which are standard model compatible. Just to remind you, their hierarchy takes you either through this symmetry breaking chain, or through this symmetry breaking chain. And the point is that if they are very close to each other, if these two are very close to each other, you are going through something which very much resembles the SU5, simply because then this is practically homogeneous, like in five dimensions. So this resembles an SU5 type direction. And this is exactly what happens here, because at least one of these is always tachyonic, unless you take these two VEFs very, very close to each other. So it looks like there is a no-go for any real intermediate symmetries. And the standard model vacuum requires this minimal SO10 model to go along one of those SU5-like descents, which means that there's no room for intermediate symmetries. And that means there's very little room for something which would be compatible with CISO and even with low energy data. Something, recall this SU5 failure of this single step breaking that I was talking about a few minutes ago. So one should perhaps discard this whatsoever, but then we are done, because we are left with nothing else, right? So there seems to be a no-go. Actually, this is not a no-go, because this calculation that I've just shown you, those masses, were calculated only at the classical level. This is, of course, the first thing one does, because it's very, very, very difficult to do such a complicated theory at quantum level. So the classical approximation is the first thing to do. But there's something like the second law of progress in particle physics, which says that one should not trust arguments based on the lowest order of perturbation theory. And it's very, very interesting that if you do obey this law, that means you don't trust what you calculated at the classical level, you go to the quantum level, you actually get out of this problem. And this is something that was done in 2010. If you like take this minimal SO10 with 45 and 126 one step ahead, that means you make it like a nightmare squared, because you have not only a very complicated classical theory, but also a very complicated structure of quantum corrections. If you fight really hard, then you can prove that actually at the quantum level, there is enough room to accommodate standard model vacuum in this Higgs model, which is non-tachyonic, which is very interesting. And this is a big business. Like there are still like ongoing, very detailed studies of this very specific quantum level scenario. I mean, it's consistent only at the quantum level. So it's, I would say, a genuine quantum theory. We are currently like performing some like perturbativity studies. So applying those other, say, consistency and usability criteria like perturbativity. And it's pretty interesting that we get like non-trivial results out of it, including like a very clear preference for one specific symmetry breaking pattern. So this is, I would say, like a physical theory at its best, because we get very, very clear predictions from it. But it's all very preliminary. Preliminarily, it should appear soon. Okay, so we've passed through this, through those quantum field theory consistency checks. So what to do next? As I said, I mean, we should do phenomenology eventually, in order to get refutability, in order to get a good prediction, like a reliable prediction, which would eventually make it possible to discard the theory or to test it. So I would eventually want to calculate what I can, and that's the proton decay or the proton lifetime. But before that, I would again like, I would like to say a few words about proton decay in general. So suppose we do find proton decay today, right? So first we would be very, very happy. Tomorrow we would wait. But from Wednesday on, we would start thinking about whether this information that we learned from the experiment, that indeed protons do decay and so on and so forth, whether it is enough to discriminate among different models, right? We would like to test what we get, what we have. And actually the answer is that in most cases, it's extremely difficult to get a good proton lifetime prediction. And we already know why, right? Because it's extremely difficult to get a good grip on the fundamental scale behind. So that's why if you look into the literature, the predictions or the typical predictions for different modes have something like 8 to 10 orders of magnitude theoretical uncertainties. And I mean, this is certainly not good to really compare it to the current data or the current or near future data. Because like people are spending like hundreds of millions of dollars to build like machines like this, right? Like those huge water Cherenkov detectors, which are actually looking for something like proton decay. These are almost like megaton scale experiments nowadays. And the improvement window that you gain or that you get if you go from say 100 kilotons to 1 megaton, like in the super K to hyper K experiment, is only something like one order of magnitudes. Indeed, because the mass of the experiments are scaled by a factor of 10, something like that. So how could you ever compare a prediction which suffers from like 10 orders of magnitude theoretical uncertainty with like this new data which improve the current limits only by a factor of 10? I mean, that's insane, right? Why is it so bad, actually? We've already seen part of the problem. That's the mediator mass determination. The mass of the exposure cannot be determined very easily, because of the Planck scale effects, because of the need to calculate the spectrum, because of the need to really work hard, like calculate everything in high loops and so on. So this is the main showstopper. But this is, as we said, this is not a showstopper for this 40-45 driven SO10. Another like very common showstopper or very traditional showstopper is the hadronic matrix element, right? Because this is a non-perturbative piece of information we need. And until recently, it was very, very difficult to get anything about it. So we are now, and in that sense, we are in a kind of unique period of time. We can now finally get a grip on this on computers, and which makes it really interesting. And the third thing that you need to know is actually the flavor structure here, because like these currents are charge currents. And that means there may be something like a CK matrix sitting here, or maybe some totally different matrix, which has to do with the diagonalization of the masses. So we need to understand the flavor structure, the Yukawa sector. And that's what brings me to at least a partial answer to one of the questions before. But first things first, so how about the hadronic matrix elements? Nowadays, we encounter like theoretical uncertainties at the level of few tens of persons, which is really good because that fits very nicely. We do need to get our predictions with better than a factor of 10 or something, within better than a factor of 10 or something like that. So hadronic matrix elements were very traditional showstoppers, but they are not showstoppers anymore. And that's very interesting. So we are left with the flavor structure. I mean, can we learn something about the flavor structure of those charge currents? And the answer is, okay, not in general, because, I mean, if you, for instance, if you look at this specific dimension six operator, the coefficients here are typically related to the matrices, as we said, like that diagonalize like quark and lepton masses. And usually these are, I mean, they come in combinations which are not directly related to what we know about flavor mixing at the low energy. Because all we know about flavor at low energy is the Kabibo-Kobayashi-Maskawa mixing matrix. And nowadays also the Maki-Nakagawa-Sakata in the leptonic sector. But these are only very, two very particular combinations. Certainly we don't know much about these combinations. However, there are specific scenarios in which you can actually say more than usual. And it, for instance, I mean, you see here that there is a down quark, unitary transformation, which brings down quarks to the mass basis. And there's a similar transformation for right-handed up quarks. And this is something we certainly don't know at the low scale, but we can learn something if the unified Yukawa sector was, for instance, symmetric, because then there is a very close correlation of the right-handed rotations and the left-handed rotations. So that would tell us something about this part, for instance. That's one thing. Second, in some channels, we can actually pretty much ignore some of the leptonic mixing effects because we can just sum over them. And in those incoherent sums, these can actually drop out. And this is the case of neutrino channels, of neutrino decay channels, because we do not measure the neutrino flavor. So if we just observe all three neutrinos, or if we ignore them, better to say, then you get this kind of sum, and maybe you can do something here. And indeed, there are very special scenarios in which at least some channels are fully calculable. That's why I'm talking about partial proton decay widths, because that's not universal. It applies only to some channels. For instance, these two look like this in the SU5 because of this symmetric feature of the up quark mass matrix, right? Everything is actually given by the elements of the CKM matrix, which is perfect because this is indeed the information we have at the low scale. But this is SU5. And actually it's pretty difficult to retain this, this kind of nice correspondence below the gut scale. I mean, if you start running those results, then you lose. I mean, this correlation is a bit loosened because the up quark and down quark mass matrices are mixing and so on and so forth. The situation is way better in the SO10 because, you also have this kind of very nice correlation between the CKM. If you assume that the quark masses are symmetric, and this is very often the case, and in particular, it's the case with 126. And this is practically my last slide. So let me just give you an example of a fully symmetric and renormalizable SO10 flavor structure, which has all those very nice features that it does tell us something about the flavor. That means it does tell us something particular proton decay channels. And yet it's very natural from the model building perspective. So let me, as I said, focus on the renormalizable SO10, because you typically need renormalizable couplings, at least for the sake of describing the top U kava. Top U kava is very large, so you cannot really live, or it's very difficult to live without renormalizable contributions. So that's why I'm looking at them first. And what can you couple to matter at the renormalizable level? Okay, that should be a dimension 4 operator. So it can be either scalars in 10 or 120 or 126 bar. So here they are. And here you can see again, few features. First, the 120 is not available here because it has anti-symmetric U-kava. So you would break your symmetry. You would break the symmetry that's mandatory in order to be able to calculate anything whatsoever. Whilst the 10 and 126 U-kavas are symmetric, so that's perfect. The 126 actually contains this intermediate scale vacuum expectation value, which is also something which sets the CISO scale, and it talks to fermions also through the right-handed neutrinos, because that's exactly where you get them. Besides that, you have at least two different types of standard mode doublets. One of them is a classical bi-doublet that you encounter also in Padi Salam. The other one is not that classical, but you also can encounter it in Padi Salam constructions. It's a bi-doublet, but it's a 15 of SU3. And the nice thing about these two is that they can together give you a completely realistic U-kava sector. There's one more detail that there's even an induced triplet VEF on this component of the 126. So you can do something called the type 2 CISO, but this is a detail. So suppose this is actually our setting, and this is the U-kava Lagrangian, which encodes all the flavor structures of the theory. So what you get in such a case are these effective mass matrices in, say, realistic scenario. So you see, they are all symmetric because all three of these U-kavas are symmetric. By the way, there's something special about the 10 scalar in the non-supersymmetric frameworks. It actually provides two independent contractions. So that means there are two different symmetric U-kava matrices. So that's why you have Y101 and Y102 here. There's another interesting feature having to do with this inhomogeneous bi-doublet of the 126, which provides actually a factor which smears the degeneracy of down quarks and charged leptons, which is something that's really necessary. Otherwise, you would get predictions which are really not okay, similarity of the strange quark mass with charge, with a charm mass, and so on and so forth. Sorry, with the muon mass. So this is how the flavor structure looks like. So we have a very, very interesting, flavor correlations. And the question is, of course, whether this can ever be realistic. And of course, it's not a simple game. One has to take into account many effects. first one has to like run these predictions down, or I would say maybe postdictions, because we know what the masses approximately are, down from the gut scale to the standard model scale, fit them, then run them up to check whether they really do conform this unified I would say framework, and so on and so forth. So this is an ongoing game. Like many people are involved in it. It's a I would say a perfect student's project, like to try to work these fits out and so on. And if you do have it, then you can go back into those charge currents, breaking baryon and lepton numbers, and you may possibly eventually calculate something about nature, which is the proton lifetime. Okay, so this is the end actually of my seminar today. Just to recapitulate or conclude, I hope we have kind of I convey the message that actually grand unified theories are theories of something rather than nothing, and this something is baryon and lepton number violation. It has, I mean, they also have to go to do with monopoles, but the main signal, I mean, the most promising measurement which may tell us something about their structure is proton decay. On the other hand, like guts are, and that's, I would say, general about most of the guts, they are notoriously difficult to calculate for various reasons. Like it's difficult to calculate if Planck scale operators are non-negligible. It's difficult to calculate if your theory is not perturbative because of, say, like nearby Landau poles due to the large number of degrees of freedom, and so on and so forth. And I hope I persuaded you that actually the SO10 guts are phenomenologically optimal in a certain sense, because they do encompass, or they do accommodate, like both types of beyond standard model phenomena that we were talking about. It's, both proton decay, or like the gut scale dynamics, and also the seesaw dynamics, which should be behind non-zero neutrino masses. And then we have seen that actually, if you ever want to calculate something in the SO10, then you possibly, or then you should kind of go this 45 route, because it's arguably the most promising one. Okay, thank you very much for your attention. Sorry I took a little bit more time.
Okay, thank you very much for that very, very nice overview. And are there any questions?
I have one question, which is about the number of parameters. So you argued that most promising gut is you need 45, you need 10, and 126. Mm-hmm. So if you write the potential, let's say renormalizable potential, yes. what's the number of parameters? Or if you don't know, what's the order of magnitude?
The number of parameters almost doubles with the extra 10. Okay, let me maybe find that slide which would demonstrate it somehow. Yeah, this one. So the number of parameters would practically double. But this does not necessarily mean that we are kind of totally doomed, because the extra 10 actually does not speak to the symmetry breaking at all, because it does not contain any standard model singlet. So from that perspective, you can do the entire analysis of the spectrum even without 10, or not the entire, like, but most of the analysis of the scalar spectrum even without 10, claiming that the effects of 10, regardless of the couplings, are small. And you can even estimate the theoretical uncertainties due to this omission. And they are not very large. And in particular, they are not very large concerning the precision with which you can determine, at least in principle, the unification scale. So 10, of course, should be there. It comes with many more parameters, but it's relatively innocent, and you can still like hope to accomplish like this program as a whole. That means like say something about the mediator scale, like and perhaps say something about proton decay, at least in those channels which are not that much sensitive to your ignorance of the extra time. I mean, did that answer your question?
I have another question. Mm-hmm. You mentioned nice talk. Did you mention that you mentioned charge quantization due to anomalies?
Mm-hmm.
And I think you said at some point that the point was that it wasn't really a good argument because you could change the hypercharge by some small B minus L contribution, mm-hmm. something along mm-hmm. those lines. But the diagram you had, I think, was a Z. It wasn't a gravitation. What I thought was that I thought gravitational anomalies. Doesn't that imply the charge quantization?
Actually, they are not independent. They are not independent. Yeah, all I'm looking, or all that's sufficient to look at, are the standard model ones. I mean, to play the charge quantization game in the standard model, once you upgrade the standard model with the right-handed neutrino, of course, then you have to, and you want to claim that you lose charge quantization like this, then you also have to consider all B minus L anomalies. That means like B minus L gauge bosons on all these legs here. But the gravity anomaly is not independent.
It's not independent, I see. So in gravity is implicitly contained somewhere in the...
Yeah, implicitly, yes.
I'm a bit surprised, but okay, yeah.
I was under the impression that the story was that if you included all the chiral anomalies, including the gravity anomaly, then the standard model with no right-handed neutrino had charge quantization. And then if you included...
I see.
All of the chiral anomalies, including all of the gauge anomalies, including the B minus L and gravity, but then you also, like Michal was saying, included the right-handed neutrino, then there is the quantization goes away because a combination of hypercharge and B minus L is anomaly free.
I didn't realize that, yeah.
Are there any other questions?
Yeah. Yes. Can I go ahead?
Yes, go for it.
I had a question regarding the energy scale of the U1 B minus L symmetry breaking. Can mm-hmm. it be as low as the electroweak energy breaking symmetry breaking scale, or something would forbid that?
Well, in some situations it can, but not as low as the electroweak scale. But it can be almost arbitrarily light or arbitrarily low in very, very specific esoteric scenarios, which are, on the other hand, are suffering from some other issues. For instance, if you have this SU3 times SU2 times U1 times U1 asymmetric setting, in such a case, the U1 B minus L can sometimes be very, very low.
Uh-huh. Okay. Thank you.
On the other hand, the question is, what would you do with such a scale? Because the B minus L is usually attributed to the seesaw, right? And the natural scale, or in quotation marks, the natural scale for seesaw is relatively large. So you have to do something about the seesaw mechanism too, if you want to push B minus L to the vicinity of the electroweak scale.
I agree.
Could I? Oh, sorry. I see Cole has a question. Sorry, go for it, Cole.
Just a quick one. I was going to ask, what's the current status on SU5 models?
Okay, so as I said, or as I tried to convey, like the minimal SU5 of Georgia and Glashow, that's ruled out by many sigmas because of the gauge coupling unification constraint, so to say. But that doesn't mean that there is no way to really build SU5 models nowadays. of course, you need to go beyond the Georgi glacier. You typically need to extend the meta sector by something which would give you massive neutrinos. Or you can extend the scalar sector with something which would give you actually type 2 CISO, which means like you would not need extra fermions. In any case, you need always something which would fix this gauge unification pattern. So what people usually do is that they like promote some of those extra fields which you throw in on top of the minimal Georgi glacial framework into the bulk, like that means quite under the gut scale. And this is what kind of fixes the gauge coupling evolution and makes it compatible with the standard model eventually. So this is for non-supersymmetric. For the supersymmetric, I mean, it's somewhat more difficult because you always need to, you always need to address the issues which are not present in the non-SUSY scenarios with overly fast proton decay because of dimension 5 operators. In the standard model or in those non-supersymmetric guts, proton decay is due to dimension 6 operators, but in SUSY it's dimension 5 and sometimes even dimension 4. So that can be rather problematic if in particular your SUSY scale is close to the electroweak scale. If you lift the SUSY scale to cure for this, then you encounter again the issues of symmetry breaking. So it's like, it's not that easy to play such a game in SUSY, but there are models which are not ruled out yet, even on the SUSY side, SU5 SUSY side.
Can I sneak another question in? Mm-hmm. What about just starting with the Petit-Salon model?
Okay, no problem. But this is not a general unification. And so there are different classes of Petit-Salon models, but you cannot claim that you don't have typically like effects like proton decay. I mean, depends on how you break Petit-Salon symmetry, but there's no proton decay, for instance, triggered by gauge degrees of freedom. You need to devise a contrived scalar sector in order to get proton decay. So, Petit-Salon is very interesting. It was actually one of the very first unifications or very first like beyond standard model gauge extensions, I would say.
Are you saying that you would mm-hmm. want proton decay? Are you saying Excuse that you me? Would want? Are you saying that you would want proton decay? Wouldn't you want to avoid it?
Well, how would you test such a thing then? No, I mean, I really cherish all those signals that actually can, provide some testability. So I would like to, that's my bias maybe, but I would really like to get some grip on the theory. So it's perhaps not proton decay because for that you have to really work hard and devise a contrived scalar sector. Concerning other possible signals, you have to obey some constraints from the gauge. It's not a real unification because you are fitting like 3 gauge couplings of the standard model to, in principle, 3 gauge couplings of Petit-Salon. Depends on whether you do have something like a left-right parity in Petit-Salon or not. If you have left-right parity, then you have only 2 couplings. And then you may get something non-trivial. Some non-trivial information about the symmetry breaking scale also from the gauge evolution. But this typically is not a low energy theory, or you don't get like a very low energy, framework. So, it's kind of, it's not a priori clear how to test such a thing. It's beautiful though. I completely agree that would be beautiful.
Thanks.
May I ask one last question? When you were, one point you had argued for using the 45 for the first stage of breaking, and then you were arguing for using 126 rather than 16 for the second stage.
Mm-hmm.
The reason you ruled out the 16 was because to write down a mass term for the neutrinos, basically the term that would become the Weinberg term, you would need a dimension 5 term if it was built from the 16s. You couldn't write down a dimension 4 term. And what? Why is that? Is that first of all, was that the only reason to rule out the 16? And if so, what is so? Could you say more about what's so bad about that? I mean, so it's non-renormalizable, but is it just that the theory is less complete, or are there sort of phenomenological problems with it?
Yeah, I mean, maybe the first thing to say is that I'm not really ruling out 16. I would say that this is actually an argument in favor of 126 rather than against 16. But like in general, this 16 breaking must be compatible with this multi-scale picture that I try to sketch. And if you do calculate the position of the B minus a breaking scale in models with 16 and 126, it turns out to be in the 10 to the 11 ballpark, so like typically. And that would mean that, for instance, here, you would have something like 10 to the 11 over the Planck scale extra suppression with respect to this 10 to the 11. So this is extra 9 orders of magnitude. So the seesaw scale would be extremely low here, right? That's the main, I mean, that's the, I'm not very comfortable with playing seesaw with such a low seesaw scale. There are other things. I mean, there's even a renormalizable scheme due to Witten. I didn't have time to really comment on, in which this can be alleviated. The smallness of the U1 B minus L scale can be kind of alleviated, but still you encounter some scale problems. So this is mainly for the implementation of the seesaw mechanism. The second thing is that you would also get a Yukawa sector, which is not renormalizable. This doesn't need to be wrong, but again, somehow open the Pandora box of non-renormalizable operators. And I would prefer not to do that if I don't need to.
Uh-huh. What I had missed that the first time around, that second reference to the Witten paper. When is that paper from, roughly?
1980.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Well, in view of time, I have a feeling we should probably call it quits then. But so thank you again, Michal, for agreeing to do this. That was very super informative talk. And I thought it was, great. Perfect.
Thank you for the invitation. It was a great pleasure.
Yeah. Thanks again.